We're set here, Drew, if you're ready to go.
Okay, I'll go ahead and get started. So looking around the names in the room, I think most of you know me. I usually show up on Tuesday evenings, but that didn't work for me to do a presentation this time. So I'm glad to be here on a Sunday morning instead, just a bit of a change of pace in the services and all that. So yeah, Domi was on sabbatical. She gave this opportunity for Sangha members to give talks. I decided to do one and to take things in maybe a somewhat different direction than what people are used to. So the talk will be about the relationship between physics, specifically like modern physics, and Buddhism. And just to give you a little bit of background as to how this idea came to be, I have been attending Bright Ways since 2018, and it was 2018, 2019, something like that, that I first heard Domio mention interdependent co-arising. And like right when I heard that phrase, like this light bulb went off in my head. And I was like, that sounds a lot like quantum mechanics or the observer effect and how the act of observation actually impacts reality. So it kind of takes two to tango, right? It takes the observer and it takes the thing being observed. So I did some research into this. Really, I poked around some different texts and really I just decided to focus on one text. So let me just share my screen real quick. Oh, it says host disabled participant screen sharing. Is there a possibility that I can get that enabled? One moment. Okay. Okay, now it looks good. Okay. So here is the, I got it on Kindle, so I don't have like an actual paper copy here. Here is the text I use. It's essentially the same name as this talk, except for it's got the Tibetan at the beginning. So Tibetan Buddhism and Modern Physics. So even though it's Tibetan Buddhism rather than Zen Buddhism, as far as the contents of this talk are concerned, there are not really any important differences between, I'm not saying in general, they're not important differences, but for this talk, there are not really important differences between Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, at least not that I noticed. If you notice otherwise, feel free to say something. So I will offer a disclaimer that I am not a physicist. I work as a statistician, so I'm kind of like involved in science and I've always had an interest in it, but physics for me is just like kind of a casual interest. I took some courses in college and whatnot. So if somebody here knows more than I do and if I say something incorrect, please don't hesitate to correct me. So a little bit about the book here, written by Vic Mansfield. It was important for me to select a book from an author who was, who I guess had the right credentials. So Vic, he died in 2008 from lymphoma, but he was a professor of physics and astronomy at Colgate University in New York. He knew the Dalai Lama, so you can see at the bottom there that the book was actually, the foreword was written by the Dalai Lama. And he seems to know what he's talking about from both a physics perspective and a Buddhism perspective. I really enjoyed this book. If you're into this type of thing, it's really not that long of a read. And of course, there are many books about this, and so this is just one. Okay. So, I will just say that with this talk, I'm not trying to make Buddhism rooted in physics or physics rooted in Buddhism, it's not to like show that one is subordinate to the other. It's just to show that there's a connection, and that the two topics seem to be pointing to many of the same things, which I think is very interesting and very, very neat. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen. I'll come back to it in a little bit. So let me give a couple of quotes here from from the author and from the Dalai Lama about why it's important to explore this relationship between Buddhism, physics, and more generally between science and Buddhism in general. Okay, so the author writes, "The Dalai Lama has taught me that the collaboration between science and spirituality can be a great avenue for the relief of human suffering." So that's one quote that points to the utility of understanding this relationship. And here's a quote from the Dalai Lama in the text. So he says, the Buddhist tradition, particularly the thousand-year-old tradition of the Indian University of Nalanda that we have inherited in Tibet, is concerned with trying to know reality, various levels of reality, through investigation, avoiding the pitfalls of underestimation and exaggeration. Modern science, too, is concerned with discovering reality, not only in theory, but also in practice by conducting repeatable experiments. Whether we approach reality through science or through a spiritual path, we have to accept it as it is. So I thought that was a very wonderful passage showing how they're the similar. Domio always instructs us, like, you have to, Buddhism is something that requires us to have an honest doubt about things, right? That we shouldn't accept things unquestioningly. And so with science, that's the same thing, right? That inherently, science needs to produce conclusions that are verifiable by others. Okay, so another quote here. This is also from the Dalai Lama. "The central question, central for the survival and well-being of our world, is how we can make the wonderful developments of science into something that offers altruistic and compassionate service for the needs of humanity and the other sentient beings with whom we share this earth." And one final quote I have here. This is from a physicist and a professor of comparative religion named Ravi Ravindra. And he writes, "It is possible to hope that modern science and ancient spiritual traditions can be integrated in some higher synthesis. I would even say that such a task is the most important of all that can be undertaken by contemporary peoples. For on such a synthesis depends not only the global survival of man, but also the creation of the right environment, right both physically and metaphysically, for future generations." So it seems to me like science holds the keys to unlocking a lot of doors. Along the avenue to alleviation of suffering, along the bodhisattva path. Okay, so I'll just stop there for a second and open it up to discussions. Does anybody have any comments or anything they want to add about, like, what they see in relationship between science and Buddhism, or how science might be helpful to Buddhism, or vice versa? Thank you. It's okay if not. Ellen, yeah, go ahead.
Well, one thing that occurs to me is, you know, depending on your you know, Western religious sort of demand a belief in God, which sometimes seems to interfere with science, belief in science, or like the idea of who says the you know, best thing about science is that it's true or whatever. Like, you can't, you know, once something is proven scientific. But I think there are people whose religion somehow interferes with believing that. But I don't know that that's an obstacle for Buddhists necessarily.
Yeah, that's very true. I think the Dalai Lama has even said that if, like, science shows that parts of Buddhism are not true, then, like, we have to go back and revisit Buddhism. But yeah, certainly certain beliefs of some religions are not compatible with what we know, or at least what we think we know from science. I do want to add one thing here. Being a statistician, I see science as not as a true representation of reality. There's a famous statistician named George Box. He has this quote. He says, "All models are wrong, but some are useful." So the science is this ongoing process of refinement, right? That ideas are constantly being refined and replaced. In a way, it points towards impermanence, right? That science is always changing. So I don't really, maybe science maybe points in the direction of truth, but it's hard to say that across the board that really it is uncovered truth everywhere, at least in my opinion. Okay, other comments or anything?
I think that there is probably a good practice of mindfulness when you're practicing science. Science is about observation. And so if we're using our mindfulness, then we're going to be better observers and therefore, you know, better able to uncover possible truths that may surface.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree with that.
Brian has his hand up.
Brian, go ahead, please.
So in my own case, I've mostly followed the Enlightenment and Kant's divorce of science from kind of metaphysics. In the Critique of Pure Reason, you know, you have science and that pragmatically tells you about the world and is falsifiable and so forth. And then you have, you know, at the time, lots of claims about the metaphysical world, the world beyond science. And, you know, Kant's view was, well, you know, whether those are true or not is not a thing we can know via science. And so kind of what's interesting now is that there is, it feels, a bit of a rapprochement between, you know, science, the, you know, that the empirical world that we look at, maybe it does have something to tell us about things like ultimate reality, whatever that is. So it's sort of, you know, it's kind of revived a set of questions that I think for many people have sort of lain dormant, you know, since the, you know, 18th century. So anyway.
Yeah. Great point. And, the author mentioned some of that in the book too. Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and I don't see any hands up, so I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen again. So I just took this right out of the text. just a Venn diagram, kind of comparing and contrasting Buddhism and science. I guess really the only overlap here is that first row, Buddhism being subjective and objective, whereas science is purely objective. Brian, as you were saying, that the objectivity of science that can be limiting. And so the question for me is, are there truths that we can access through Buddhism that we cannot access through science, right? Maybe it's that those truths are personal truths, right? Maybe that they are not objective truths. And that's, I guess, what the next row says, right? That Buddhism is personal, as science is public. Essentially that, meaning that like it's public, that anybody with the right knowledge and technology could verify scientific results, right? Quantifiable versus Buddhism non-quantifiable, science quantifiable. The last row I maybe take a bit of issue with. Buddhism definitely meaningful, but I wouldn't say science is necessarily without meaning. It's when I guess when you read a result, like it's always needs to be interpreted, right? So the science, like why would we do science if it were entirely meaningless? So that interpretation piece, I think, is part of science. Okay. There's additional quotes in the text about how the Dalai Lama regards it as essential that this conversation between Buddhism and science, and not just Buddhism and science, but religion and science in general, that conversation occur. And the author kind of takes it upon himself to kind of promote this conversation. This is not his like first book on this topic. Okay. So the book is maybe like 60% Buddhism, 40% physics, something like that. There's a, it's not real technical, but I suspect that many people in the audience are not like real, may not be familiar with relativity and things like that. So I'm going to kind of, also I'm not a physicist, so I can't explain this stuff super well. So I'm going to stick to just kind of a couple of examples. That the concepts I'm going to focus on here are quantum mechanics and special relativity. So quantum mechanics is essentially it's a model, and it describes how nature behaves at the microscopic level. It's the behavior of particles and very small things. And these things don't really behave like the way we think we do. We you know, observe in our usual macroscopic lives. So here's a concrete example. So we all know that like N95 masks are like the gold standard for coronavirus, right? Those are the ones that you want to have. Okay. What does N95 mean? So the 95 means that 95% of particles of a size of, I believe it's 0.1 microns, are filtered out by the mask. Now, in your mind's eye, you probably got something like, you know, the colander you drain your pasta in, right? Where the smaller the holes, the harder it is for stuff to get through. Okay, so what quantum mechanics shows us is that the smaller, when we get down to those microscopic scales, is that things start to behave based on probabilities and randomness. So very counterintuitively, that 0.1 micron size for an N95 mask, that is the size of particle at which the mask is least effective at blocking. Smaller particles than that, it's actually better. So why the heck is that? So it has to do, again, with this random behavior. So larger particles kind of behave more like a stream, like your colander in your kitchen, your strainer. But these smaller particles, they wander around, right? So they're kind of like jiggling in and out of your mask just randomly. And well, the more times they cross through your mask, the more likely they are going to be caught by it one of those times, right? So the world of the very small is very different than what we typically experience. With that, so quantum mechanics, the description of the microscopic world, I'll put it that way. So they're elementary particles in physics, right? So there's atoms, which consist of protons and neutrons and electrons, and those consist of quarks. And there's all sorts of other stuff, you know, gluons, muons. I've heard of this stuff before, but I don't really know that much about it. I don't remember. But one of the things about these particles is that any two particles of the same type, so let's just say two electrons, for instance, they are not distinguishable from one another, right? So if I have electron over here, they are exactly alike. There's nothing that I mean, they might have certain properties, but just in, there's not really any obvious way for me to tell them apart. Okay, so the author gives this example where if you have two electrons in a box and one has one set of properties and the other has the other set of properties, and then you keep the particles the same, but you swap their properties. If you perform measurements on that box containing the electrons, like, it's going to read identically. So you can't tell the differences in this system. And the comparison he makes is with people. So, I mean, clearly, like, I can tell the difference between, you know, you and I, or two of you, any two of you can tell the difference between other people. But the phrase that kind of gave me an epiphany in Zen when I was reading one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, and he described not the same and not different. So those particles, I think, are not the same and not different. And people, in many regards, are not the same and not different. So the quality that really makes people like not distinguishable from one another is our desire to be happy and to be free of suffering. So in that regard, people are equal, right? I mean, we each have like equal claim to that desire to be happy and to be free of suffering. And, you know, that there are large moral implications for that, right? I mean, it implies like, what, you know, what, why should we help these people over here, not these people over there? Why should we care more about this group of people, or, you know, this problem or that problem? But ultimately, I think what it points to is, the Bodhisattva path and the vows, and the vow to free all beings, right? It's not just ourselves that we're trying to free. It's freeing all beings. And if we believe that we're all interconnected, it seems like we kind of have to do, to get free ourselves, we have to free everything. And so I think that's kind of reflected in the Bodhisattva vows there. Um, So one of the very intriguing results of quantum mechanics, let me stop sharing my screen here, is it's called non-locality. And Einstein, among others, believed that nothing, even information, could travel faster than the speed of light. That was like a finite limit. And it's not so much that like that's not true. It's just that there can be something called quantum entanglement. Einstein described it as spooky action at a distance. So if you get like a particle pair and you, I'm not exactly sure how this is done, but you entangle them somehow, it's like the overall properties of the system have to remain constant. So like if they have like no net spin, for instance, like if you, even if these things are a billion light years apart, right? If you turn one this way to like counteract that, the other one immediately turns the other way. So these things somehow seem to be communicating faster than the speed of light. And it points to an interconnectedness of things that is not dependent on distance. So I found that aspect very interesting. I would say the main theme in the book was really about emptiness, really, and how science essentially shows emptiness to be true. So let me let me bring my notes on this thing. Okay, let me give kind of a couple of definitions. We've heard these things as Buddhists before, but you know, there's lots of different ways of saying them. So the way the author describes interdependent co-arising is, when I hear, it's called emptiness for a reason, right? So emptiness maybe versus somethingness, like the opposite of somethingness is not nothingness, it's emptiness. So in my mind, there's a distinction to be made between emptiness and nothingness. So we think of emptiness as being devoid of any inherent self nature, right? In my mind, it's unsatisfying and maybe a little bit unclear to define it as the lack of something rather than like a something. So I like the way the author describes interdependent co-arising and then also emptiness. So let me read off what he writes here. Okay, so he writes, rather than the pure negation of emptiness, we can positively characterize ultimate that all things are dependently arisen, dependent upon causes and conditions, whole and parts, and mental designation. Dependent arising emphasizes the deeply relational and interdependent nature of all persons and things and is equivalent to emptiness. Emptiness and dependent arising are like two sides of one hand, with impermanence radiating from both sides. Okay, so he goes on to write kind of like clarifying emptiness. Mostly my words. So I wrote, simply put, emptiness is the lack of a self nature or inherent characteristics of any object or being continuing through time. As I was saying earlier, defining emptiness as a lack of something rather than something feels unsatisfying. We use the term emptiness rather than nothingness. The author Mansfield writes, positively stated, all things and persons exist only through their mutual interdependence. So let me share my screen again real quick. Let's see, where the heck is it? Okay, so hopefully you can see figure 4.1 and 4.2 on the left and right. It's not like terribly earth shattering, but when you read the words behind it, it is very interesting. So in our day-to-day experiences and the way we're used to thinking about the world, we think of objects as being fixed and real, and kind of the relationships as being kind of secondary or subordinate to the object. So he's trying to show that through these three posts, you know, saying, okay, these dark solid things, these are the things that matter. And then the dotted lines between them, those are the relationships and those are secondary. But that's not really the way that reality functions, right? Reality is based on primarily the relationships between things, right? The objects are secondary. So with his second figure there, he's trying to say, hey, the relationships are the things that matter, that objects are the less important things. So when I was reading through this, I was reminded by one of our readings. Dogen, maybe I think I have like a good memory for the readings themselves, but not actually like who said them. But he writes, you know, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. And so this emphasis on the importance of relationships between things, that really confirms that statement to me, that you know, being verified by all things, like nothing is well, I don't know if I want to say go far as like nothing exists, but I'd say nothing is well defined without examining the relationships to the other things around it. And it's just, maybe it's not like completely clear to me from like a spiritual or like a deep belief standpoint yet that everything is interconnected, but at least from an intellectual perspective, I can see that it's true. And I feel like that's a good start, right? I mean, if I can kind of believe it with my head, then maybe that's means that I can make it there with my heart eventually. Okay. I think now might be a good time to just pause for a minute and see if there's any comments or anything anybody wants to add. Any personal thoughts you've had about these types of things or anything at all?
I'll just kind of throw something random out there because I've been considering it. You were talking about, the Dalai Lama said that if science were to sort of disprove something about Buddhism, that we'd have to revisit Buddhism. But I think in terms of Zen Buddhism, in terms of our practice, I'm having a hard time thinking of anything, even theoretically, that physics could offer up that would cause us to reevaluate any part of our practice, given that, you know, even the literal existence of the Buddha isn't really that big of a deal to the fundamentals of our practice. I mean, it's just, and I think just our practice in particular, I know there's other traditions of Buddhism that differ from ours, but ours isn't so much about, I think, reality, so much as it's about how we experience reality and relate to reality. But it's not, in our case, very descriptive. Like we're not saying, well, Buddha did this, and so the world is this way. It's different to that. And so at a certain level, I almost feel like comparing comparing physics to Zen Buddhism is really apples to oranges in terms of like the science that concerns itself with the same thing that we concern ourselves with, the psychology. And that, I think, as it's grown up, has become more and more Buddhism-like. So that's completely different analysis. But yeah, I don't know. I'm just wondering what physics could do that would change my mind about anything in terms of Zen Buddhism. It might be a random thought, but you opened up for random thoughts, so you get what you ask for.
I don't know. Maybe it points to the relationships. I mean, it currently doesn't, but maybe it were to point that like relationships aren't the important things and that things do actually have an inherent independent existence. I think that would throw things quite a bit off kilter. But I take your point that given that they seem to be pointing to the same truths, and really that's kind of the theme of the talk, maybe the value is more like confirmatory than anything else. I guess I kind of just wondered, like, reading about this physics stuff, like did the Buddhists see something like millennia before, you know, modern science? I think maybe they could have seen some things, right? Not everything, but it's an interesting question. Yes, Brian.
I really appreciate this. I like that diagram, the two figures. And anytime I get to talk about Kant, you know, I just, you know, it's a good day. And I wanted to nominate a word for the dark lines connecting the dotted line posts, and that is sentience. So, you know, if we look at the world as this, not the world, but this flow of stuff, right? So let's assume it starts, at least in this universe, with a big bang, and it's just flowing. And it's been doing that for 13.7, you know, billion years, and we hope it's going to keep on doing it for a while. And we're part of it. You know, we get thrown up. So far as we know, our ability to reflect on all of that is also part of all of that. And so while when we say there's a relationship, it's all just flowing, but then we, through our sentient reflective capacities, we via science or other modes of reflection, you know, we try to make sense of it. You know, we explain it, we observe it, we devote our attention to segments of it. We posit relationships, mathematical, between some segments of it and other segments of it. So at any rate, that was a nice, it's a nice illustration. And it's, I know it's a little far afield, but there are some perennial puzzles in philosophy that I think Buddhism also throws a light on. And one is the is-ought division that bedevils ethicists. You know, why, you know, how is it that we get to a normative statement about what should be good just from neutral facts? And but we're part of those neutral facts. You know, we aren't just we are arisen by the muck and the mire of the universe. And as part of that, we try to make sense of the muck and the mire of the universe. And then we try to make it a better universe, our little segment of it. So anyway, so this is a really a fruitful set of points that you've brought to our attention. I appreciate it. So,
yeah, thanks for that. My thought as you're talking was, is there such a thing as neutral facts? I've always been fascinated by the question, like, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody around to hear it, does it make sound? What does the universe look like if there are no beings in it? It doesn't even really make sense to ask that question, because looking is a property only possessed by beings, right? And so maybe that...
You and Kant agree completely.
Yeah. Well, okay. Maybe my next talk or your talk needs to be about Kant next. But this sounds like a very interesting thing to explore. I believe Jinryu is next, and then Linda.
I really appreciate this talk. I can't wait for the recording to be put on the website, because I do want my husband to listen to it. But apropos of Dave's comment, there are scientists who don't believe that psychology is a science. And I happen to be married to one. So there's that. But one of the things I thought of, and I don't know that there is an answer to this, or maybe a student of the religious history of Hinduism and the Vedas and the Upanishads and all that could tell, but the fact that somebody like a Buddha came up with this is fascinating to me. What was he thinking?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's what what was he thinking? And so related to that, and this is kind of a personal question, did you have to do some sort of analysis like this in order to be comfortable in your own practice?
Not consciously. I've always been kind of inclined towards science, and I don't know, my brain makes strange connections here and there. And so I think it's like, I see something over here and there's something over here, and then while I'm sleeping or something, my mind connects some dots, like, whoa, that's really interesting. I wonder if there's something there that's worth exploring further. So I never made a conscious decision to do that, but unconsciously, perhaps. Linda.
Hi, thanks so much, Drew. This is really fascinating. I love this topic, and I love hearing people talk about it, because some of these books are just too much for me to get into reading. So I love to hear you present it with your spin on it also. One thing that came up when you were talking about quantum entanglement, which is when the two types of, I don't know what they were, protons or something even smaller, will react, will do the same thing even if they're billions of light years away. And then talking about interconnectedness, and also you talked about how things, very, very small things, behave differently. And perhaps on a larger level that we're not really able to see, we are being affected the same by different things, but we're just so much bigger that you can't really see it. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense, but you and I and everybody on this planet or in this country are all having the same effects, even on a physical level, but it's not visible to us, or we can't observe that in the same way that those two little tiny things are being affected the same way from far away. I don't know if that's clear or makes sense at all, but it's something that came up that kind of made sense to me at the time.
So maybe what you're referring to is like, so, you know, inside of our brains, right, we still got all this quantum activity. We've got this random particles stuff going on in our brain, right? And the question is, does that manifest itself somehow in our mental states? Is that kind of your question or your thought?
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
I'm not quite sure. It's something, yeah, just the fact that we are being affected the same way by things, or we are being changed the same way, but the same things are happening to us, but it's not something that's as visible as if you're looking at these two tiny little things, you can see exactly what's happening to them. That's the same because of quantum entanglement.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's, sure. It is, well, I mean, yeah, it's more obvious, like when we purposely like tie these things together and move them far apart, and we can, you know, move one around and the other one does the same thing. But I think it does kind of point to like karma, like, and, you know, if I suffer, you suffer, if you suffer, I suffer. Right. There is like one thing that like the Dalai Lama like found disturbing about quantum mechanics is there's like two types of causality, right? So if you think of like your ordinary type of causality, like you're playing billiards or whatever, and you hit one ball into another, and it, you know, the collision is very predictable as to where the ball goes. Like that type of causality is like very pretty straightforward, and like, I guess, compatible with Buddhism. These quantum phenomena, so I don't want to go down too far in a rabbit hole here, but you might have heard of like light having this dual nature between wave and particle, and you can't, if you choose to measure it as a wave, it's a wave. If you choose to measure it as a particle, it's a particle. It's never both at the same time. But the truth is, it's not like it is one or the other and we just can't see it. It's truly in an indeterminate state before it's measured. So a lot of these quantum phenomena are like this, that you have something that's in a completely undetermined state, and then the determined state is created by the act of observation itself. And the act of like what that observation shows is thought to be based on just probability alone. And so like, what causes that? Well, nothing, right? I mean, that's nothing. It's just, that's the outcome that, you know, it's the toss of the dice, right? That's the one that happened to the face that happened to turn up. Called, I think they call it like type one evolution is kind of like your billiard balls impacting, and then type two is this random phenomenon like manifesting. And it's kind of the one thing that I've never really understood or appreciated in Buddhism, I never really could wrap my head around how it works, like this karma. Like I can kind of get like, oh yeah, you know, like if I can't hurt you without hurting myself. Like that seems like, yeah. Like, I mean, if I'm a jerk to you, like I notice like afterwards I'm feel bad inside. Right. So I can kind of understand that, but this whole, like, I don't know, web of causes and conditions and how things will come back and, you know, eventually get to me in this life or the next. And when, you know, when you've got all of this inherent randomness present, like it kind of seems to throw it all off kilter. And the author mentions this as well. And so it's like the one area where maybe, and maybe come back to today's question as well, like what can physics teach Buddhism? Like maybe there's something that drives me a little bit batty when it comes to karma. It just doesn't click with me. Not fully, like partially, but so just some more food for thought there.
I think Alice wants to speak.
Oh, thank you, Jinryu. Yes, Alice, please go ahead.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So I hope I can say this eloquently, because theoretical and modern physics is actually quite, well, as you might know, it's difficult to describe in layman's terms. So I'm going to try my best to kind of talk about the journey that I've been on personally. with Buddhism, I learned that my perspective is not always right. Your perspective is also not always right. If I'm not true, you are not true. So what is true? So that was the main question that led me down this path of seeking Buddhism, but also mathematical theories and also physical theories. So we're kind of delving into mathematical models and physical models. And then the book, Robin Wright, Why Buddhism is True, that also helps me gel everything together. So let me bring up an example that kind of stuck in my head a bit. There's a beetle in Australia, and I'm sorry if I don't remember the genus and species here, but there's a beetle in Australia that lives in the desert. And the male part of this beetle looks for mates who are green and shiny. And unfortunately, this beetle is becoming extinct, mostly because a lot of tourists have started chucking green Coke bottles out their car while they were visiting Ayers Rock. And why is that significant? Because to the beetle, to the male beetle, it started mating with these green Coke bottles with reckless abandon to the point where there's no more procreation of that beetle or less. And it was interesting to me because biologically, that beetle was designed and coded to look for shiny green objects to mate with. That is all it sees. And that just blew my mind because I know we have two eyes that look forward and we have a brain that processes theories and speaks and thinks and has thoughts. And we can be so intelligent that we can see light as a wave or a particle, depending upon what we measure it with, whether we see refraction, whether we test light refraction, whether we test particle physics, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, we still cannot explain why things are the way they are. And mathematically, it's because we live in this coda of a human being and we are meant to see things the way they are, how we interpret it. So I feel and I read that reality isn't what we think it is. It's maybe more complicated or more simple, but either way, our interpretation of it is not complete and is far from complete and is far from being understandable. Now, how do I link that to Buddhism? Is that maybe myself, I'm a beetle empirically. I'm a beetle. I don't know the difference between fundamental things sometimes. I believe that my thoughts are true, which I also know they're impermanent, they change. The main thing that I feel that I know why Buddhism is true is because of impermanence and the lack of a self. And that's how I kind of tie theoretical physics along with Buddhism, is that if I don't know what reality is, then who am I? And I know that things will change. Things always change. So this is where my communication breaks down, because I don't know how to eloquently say this, but I hope at least some of you understand what I'm trying to communicate. I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Alice. The one thing I'll add to that is the author, I love the way he puts this, is he says, human beings suffer, we suffer because of our misconception of reality. That is the reason for our suffering, right? And we're taught that too, is right. I mean, the Dharma is the medicine for all suffering. What's the Dharma? Well, it's the truth, right? I mean, it is kind of like the fundamental reality. For me, that's like a very useful characterization. Like, you know, suffer because we have these misconceptions about, you know, whatever. But really, yeah, we just don't understand what reality is. And the closer we can get to understanding reality, the less we suffer. Okay. Jinryu?
I just have one last minute comment, sure. And that is on this topic of karma, and I think you mentioned it, this is probably very well where psychology comes in. But in my own talk, I struggled with emptiness for so long. And I mentioned, or the concept of no self, and I mentioned, you know, if anybody has, if there's an aspect in Buddhism that you just don't get and you can't get your head around it, I say let it go. When the time comes, you'll dig into it. Because that time came for me, and it was last year on a particular topic. The other thing is, when I think about karma, is I don't think about past lives. I don't even go there. But I can think about past generations and the things that I inherited, and whether or not I'm passing them on. So I don't know if that's helpful to you or anyone, but I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah, that is helpful. I mean, just things will come in time, right? Okay. I don't want to keep anybody past time. So let's go ahead and call it a day. Thank you all for listening. Jinryu, do you want to say the verse, or should I do it?
I can do it.
Okay.
We offer the merit of this discussion to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thanks, Drew.
Great talk.